Welcome to Beyond the Show, the podcast home of all things Cannabis Conference. My name is Eric Sandy, and I'm the digital editor of the Cannabis Group at GIE Media. I'm recording this introduction as the U.S. Senate Banking Committee holds a hearing on cannabis businesses' access to banking and, inevitably, the prospects of the Safe Banking Act. We're going to have some reporting on that ever-present legislation up on CannabisBusinessTimes.com, so do keep an eye out for that. And our interview this week does get into that difficult intersection between the cannabis industry and the federal government. But before getting to our conversation, have you checked out the Cannabis Conference website recently? We've been adding new speakers pretty much daily and sharing plans with our newsletter subscribers. We're only about 3 months out from the show, which means that the behind-the-scenes work is in high gear. And we're getting very excited to deliver our biggest and best cannabis conference yet. Make sure to stop by the website after listening to the show and peruse our agenda for 2023. I'm also going to just pause here real quick and say apologies for my voice this week and probably on next week's show as well. I'm nursing a little bit of a cold here, and I feel like it's coming through in the recorded interviews and certainly now. So bear with me, and I know I'm not alone in going through one of those springtime colds here. That being said, on the podcast this week, we spoke with Rafi Aliyah Crockett. Rafi is a former commissioner with the Washington, D.C. Alcoholic Beverage and Cannabis Control Board and currently serves as treasurer of the Cannabis Regulators of Color Coalition and has more than 15 years of leadership in risk and regulatory compliance and is now the principal at Maroon Consulting. So we got into some of those broader risk and regulatory compliance related issues, certainly around the D.C. market and much more broadly, as Rafi was on another webinar this week dealing with interstate commerce. So we got into that. We'll share the webinar details as well so you can follow up on that event, which happened on May 10th. And in the meantime, though, please enjoy my conversation with Rafi Aliyah Crockett. Hello, Rafi, and welcome to the show this week. Very glad to have a chance to talk with you a bit about Washington, D.C. and the Cannabis Regulators of Color Coalition, as well as some interstate commerce issues. And we'll be talking about that for a particularly timely reason. We'll get to that in a moment here. To begin, I figure maybe we would start with Washington, D.C. And we do a fair amount of reporting on the district here at Cannabis Business Times. But I know that there's a lot going on there, a lot of recent news in D.C. And yet it may fly under the radar for a lot of folks who are sort of looking at other parts of the U.S. that are legalizing and doing different things. So maybe to begin, could you describe your work with the regulatory board in D.C. and bring us up to speed on what might be happening in the district these days?
Sure. So I served on the Alcoholic Beverage and Cannabis Board from July 2019 until just a few days ago. In fact, my term ended on Monday. Sometime like that. And so my role was really to help transition the medical cannabis program from the Department of Health, where it had been for many years, over to the Alcoholic Beverage and Cannabis Administration. So due to the limitations placed on DC by Congress, the city only has a medical cannabis program. And we can, you know, talk a lot about that later on. But despite, you know, 70% of voters approving a ballot initiative that would have allowed for adult sales way back in 2014, that's been blocked. And so we only have a medical cannabis program in the city. And so as a result of this congressional meddling for nearly a decade, we've had an extremely small regulated market. In fact, we have about 15 licenses to be exact in the city. And the result of that is obviously a very thriving unregulated market. And that's, you know, due to congressional meddling that prevented us from implementing an adult sales regulatory regime, as well as inaction for a decade by the city's legislature.
Yeah, it's a very interesting predicament. And I'm going to imagine that a lot of folks listening who don't live in D.C. or don't work in D.C. might not be terribly familiar with this. Before getting into some of those market conditions that you mentioned, could you maybe briefly describe the Home Rule Act and just sort of
illustrate that connection between Congress and the district itself?
Sure. So the Home Rule Act of 1973, it granted, you know, limited self-determination to the residents of the nation's capital. I mean, we are the only capital in the world whose residents are intentionally left out of national government. So what the Home Rule Act did was allowed us to elect a mayor and a 13-person city council. You know, prior to that, so I'm talking prior to 1975, this isn't, you know, ancient days, this is just 50 years ago. So prior to the Home Rule Act's implementation, DC residents were ruled by commissioners and council members who were appointed by the president. Now, mind you, we couldn't even vote for this president who was making these appointments until 1963. That was required an amendment to the Constitution. So the 23rd Amendment to the Constitution actually allows DC residents to vote for the president, and we didn't have that right until 63. So what this limited home rule and limited self-determination really means is that Congress has to approve all of our legislation. Congress also has to approve our budget. And I'm talking about a budget made up of tax dollars that we collect locally. This isn't federal money, this is local money. And Congress gets to tell us what we can and can't do with that money. And they routinely use that power to just usurp the will of DC residents by overturning our democratically enacted legislation and by blocking voter approved ballot initiatives, such as the one I mentioned earlier in 2014, which would have allowed for an adult sales market to take hold here in DC. Just a few weeks ago, they overturned our revised criminal code, which citizens, advocates, policymakers worked on for over 10 years. And Congress just came in and said, you know, we don't want that to happen. They overturned that. And a few days ago, they also voted to disapprove our Police Accountability Act. So this is the tyranny under which DC residents live, 700,000 of us, who are not able to have effective self-determination like every other citizen of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, just on face value, it's very astonishing. And I know, you know, anyone in the cannabis industry can relate at least to the frustrations of the federally illegal status of the plant and the way that the federal government has gone about cannabis policy or not gone about it. But this is a step beyond that even for folks living in the district. And so, as you mentioned, I mean, you're just scratching the surface there. There's a ton of history here and a lot of implications between the connection between Congress and DC, and mm-hmm. enough to fill at least one documentary. And of course, Higher Power recently came out, and that details this connection a little bit, gets into the broader fight for statehood and this long process of legalization. So before going back into some of the market trends in DC, I was curious, with this documentary project, what compelled you and Dewey Ortiz Jr. to pursue a film project to tackle this problem that you were just outlining?
Sure. So 4 years ago, because this documentary was 4 years in the making, I had this idea actually to make a film that was highlighting Black owners in the cannabis industry. You know, as we know, there's, you know, less than like 2% Black ownership nationwide, but DC is very unique in that we have close to 30% Black ownership here. So I thought it would be great to make a film highlighting this. We wanted to show those success stories instead of the story that we are being left out of this regulated industry, because that just becomes kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. You don't see people that look like you in a space, and so then you are hesitant to jump into that space. So the original goal of the film was to highlight, you know, Black cannabis operators here in DC, but it's, you know, impossible to tell that story in DC without talking about and addressing the city's lack of statehood. So that's how the film kind of morphed into, you know, talking about cannabis legalization here in DC through this lens of racial justice and our fight for statehood and self-determination.
Absolutely. And, you know, like you had mentioned earlier, one of the I guess, broader issues that has gotten hung up in this conflict, I suppose, would be adult use legalization in D.C. And one of the ripple effects of that is this, you know, the term gray area gets used, this idea of these gifting retailers that are able to sell cannabis in sort of this gifting setup. And I know other states have seen this occur in different places. But very recently, under the ABC board in D.C., this licensing window has opened up for those gray area retailers to pursue medical cannabis dispensary licenses. And so this is one sort of, I guess, downstream effect of this fairly complicated tension between Congress and D.C. But at least for those gray area retailers, so to speak, there's a path to licensure now. So I'm curious, just in recent weeks even, what has the response been like so far from the marketplace now that this licensing window is open?
So actually, the licensing period for the unregulated operators won't open until November 1st. The window that opened on May the 1st was for current operators as well as for social equity applicants. So the recently enacted legislation, which passed in December and was fully enacted in March after doing what? Going through a congressional review, of course. So that legislation set really clear timelines for when current operators could apply for licenses. And also, as you stated, for those operating in the unregulated market to transition over. However, that legislation was completely silent on social equity applicants. So it was really important for the ABC board to establish by regulation a period that would allow them to move at the same time as current license holders and not place them at a further disadvantage while giving others, you know, first mover preference. And so for the flourishing unregulated market, it just makes common sense to try to bring them into the regulated market for so many reasons, for, you know, health and safety reasons, for, you know, commerce reasons, so that patients can feel comfortable about where they're shopping, so that the city is receiving necessary tax revenue and can go ahead and reinvest that into the communities that were harmed most by cannabis prohibition. So the response to that has been good. You know, people are saying that they are going to apply to transition over come November 1 when that period opens. But I think it's still, you know, we'll see how that actually works out. It's very different, you know, to work with the government, to work within a regulated market, to have to get a seed to sale tracking system, to have, you know, regular inspections by regulatory authorities. And so we will see if the operators are really up for that new type of scrutiny and observation.
Certainly, yeah. Even on the best of days, the path to being licensed isn't really a walk in the park. So that'll be quite the journey and quite the learning experience, I suppose. And I do want to get into some more social equity issues and certainly interstate commerce. But while we're talking about DC specifically, you know, like I said, I think a lot of times the wave of state by state legalization kind of takes the headlines and leads the news of the day. And that's sort of how people talk about the cannabis industry. And DC just kind of gets a little bit lost. And I'm curious, and maybe the answer to this question just simply is these home rule implications that you had mentioned. But what should non-Washington, DC cannabis operators know about the Washington, DC cannabis landscape? Maybe we've already been talking about it a bit, but are there certain aspects that would benefit the knowledge of other folks who aren't in DC necessarily?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we have unique challenges that have caused us to create unique solutions. And the first of those is, you know, we are a medical only market because of our unique congressional challenges, but we were able to do some things that set us apart and really allow for greater patient access. So first, we have reciprocity with any U.S. state or territory. So you come here, you bring your medical patient card from, you know, right next door in Maryland or as far away as Guam, And you can shop in our licensed medical retailers with your medical card from any US state or territory that has a medical cannabis program. The second thing is that we allow self-certification for adults over 21. So even if you do not have a medical card from DC or another state, you can come here. You can certify that you are, in fact, using cannabis for medical purposes, and we will grant you a temporary digital card that you can use at our licensed retailers. And I think those are, two really creative and unique ways that we've expanded access, expanded opportunity for not just residents, but also visitors to partake in our medical cannabis program, and to allow for those licensed operators to have greater commerce in their businesses. And then finally, I think this is just a shameless plug, but one that is certainly in the best interest of the public. If there is anyone out there who is interested in operating a testing lab in Washington, D.C., we are in desperate need of a testing lab, and we are accepting applications for a testing lab on a rolling basis. So you can visit abca.dc.gov to learn more about the testing lab application process. The application fee, I think, is $3,500, and our annual registration fee is $7,500. But yes, for folks outside who might be interested in coming into this market, please come with a testing lab. That's what we really, really need here.
No, that's fantastic. I'm glad you're mentioning that, because I think that particular business type, or just supply chain link, that doesn't seem unique to DC necessarily. There's a real bottleneck at the testing point in a lot of state markets as well. But I'm glad you're mentioning that, because that can be a real hindrance to the broader supply chain in any market, DC included, of course.
Exactly.
And yeah, the other things you mentioned there, those are things that regulators across the US can certainly learn some lessons from on how DC is doing it, including the reciprocity issue. I know some states do that, but not all. And I'll use that as a segue to the broader conversation that you may be having with other regulators across the industry as the treasurer of the Cannabis Regulators of Color Coalition. And I know that group made, at least from my vantage point, a pretty big splash last summer with a presentation on safe banking and equitable access to cannabis banking. But could you maybe briefly describe that organization's mission and your work there?
Sure. So the Cannabis Regulators of Color Coalition, CRCC, as I'll just refer to us, we're a coalition of current and former regulators, like myself, former as of 3 days ago. But yeah, so we're current and former regulators from both medical and adult use markets across the nation and abroad. And we really focus on equity-centered regulation, establishing industry best practices, and kind of having some competencies and standardization that we can all agree to, hopefully, as we move this wave of legalization, across the city, and globally as well. Our mission really is to be a source of education for federal and local legislators and government agencies. We hope to identify and eliminate, racial disparities, not just in cannabis policy, but in so many other policies that have implications as well. And we want to build sustainable and reparative cannabis regulatory frameworks. We think that, dismantling the drug war and its impacts, community investment, protection for cannabis patients, and preventing monopolies are some of our key principles and things that we are laser focused on.
Yeah, one thing I've noticed, I guess, in the last couple of years, as time has gone on, is that this broader conversation is becoming a bit more centered. Certainly, at least from my vantage point, in sort of cannabis-focused media, and I guess also in some of the mainstream media outlets as well. But cannabis is fertile ground for this kind of conversation, and hopefully could be a leader for other industries to follow suit. I know there are prohibition and the war on drugs is specific to cannabis, but I think social equity as a broader topic can certainly be lent to other industries. So I'm curious, as time has gone on, are there certain areas of strength that you're seeing emerging in cannabis regulatory policy? And I know that's a big question to bite off, but I guess what I mean by that is, are there certain states that might be centering social equity in more effective ways than others, or certain best practices that might be emerging that you'd like to point to?
Yes, I think centering is always an interesting choice of words, because we can look at legislation and think that, oh, wow, this is great. This is really, you know, centering returning citizens, centering individuals and communities and families that have been targeted by the war on drugs. This is what's really going to be equitable and reparative. And then the devil is always in the details, and it putting your money where your mouth is what is really going to show and prove what centering truly means. And so we've looked at, you know, we all got really excited about, you know, New York's legislation was amazing. And we got super excited last year, like what might happen with the card licenses. There was going to be $200 million. There was going to be turnkey retailers. And we started looking like, oh, this could be a model. This could be a true pathway. And unfortunately, that hasn't quite materialized yet. But I don't want the focus to be on, oh, social equity programs are failing. And I think, as we'll talk about later, it's like legalization is failing, and legalization is failing because it's artificial and it defies the laws of everything that we know to operate in markets. And so I don't, you know, ever want people to say, oh, social equity programs are not working. I want us to be like, well, they're not working because the larger market isn't working. And so how can you have a program within a failing market that you expect to somehow succeed? And I can even look here, you know, in DC, you know, with our law that just took effect this March, it's been on the horizon, you know, for years. I think it was first introduced 2 years ago, like February 2021. So we had, you know, more than enough time for agencies to kind of get on board, to start preparing for what this might look like. Yet here we are, you know, a few months after enactment, but, you know, quite some years after introduction, and we still haven't implemented this social equity fund that is supposed to be mandated by the law. We still haven't put any procedures in place for how we're going to provide grants to the social equity applicants and get them access to the capital that is 100% necessary, because these programs without the money behind them are pretty much useless. And I don't want DC, I don't want DC to end up with, oh yeah, we can say we issued, you know, 50 new social equity licenses. Well, that's great. But if none of them are able to open their doors, then we're not doing our job and we're not doing right by the individuals who we claim we want to make whole again.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that's a major gap, is just that access to capital. And, you know, again, I think everyone's aware that the getting into cannabis in the best of times is an extremely cost prohibitive type of venture. But are you seeing any examples of really good public funding initiatives? I know you mentioned some grants that may or may not materialize in certain markets. But are there examples of grant funding programs that have been working that might be good examples for other states to look to?
I think that, you know, we keep looking for unique grant programs for cannabis. And I, you know, am able to look at so many of the grant programs that we have right here in DC that are not at all cannabis related. They're just small business related. And like, instead of trying to recreate the wheel just for cannabis, we have, you know, this fantastic program that allows small businesses, Black and Brown owned businesses, access to real estate capital. So it's, you know, up to $750,000 or 20% of the purchase price, you know, whichever is greater. We provide that is grants to individuals. We have a fresh food and manufacturing grant for individuals who are engaged in providing, you know, fresh foods in certain neighborhoods that are considered food deserts in the city. So why can't folks who are doing work in the cannabis space and in the food space have access to those types of grants? So I think we need to look at what we've already done, what we already have, and just apply that to cannabis businesses. They're not any different than everybody else. They are, you know, if we're talking about small businesses, minority-owned businesses, they still have the same needs and some greater needs, especially when it comes to extending loans and financing. But let's not recreate the wheel here. We have programs in place. Let's make sure that our cannabis operators have access to them.
Yeah, there's certainly a tendency in the industry to overcomplicate things. And like you said, this desire to keep reinventing the wheel every other week, it seems like. And maybe that's a good segue into the interstate commerce conversation, which has been going on for a number of years and in many ways seeks to address some of the, early state-by-state missteps, perhaps, in the industry over the last 10-plus years. And interstate commerce, of course, is itself a complicated legislative conversation, but we are speaking here on May 10th, just a few hours before a webinar hosted by the Alliance for Sensible Markets on the present state and future of interstate commerce as legislative policy. Of course, you'll be on that webinar. And so from your vantage point here, I guess, why is this an important topic right now to be getting into?
Well, for me, I'm interested in interstate commerce because I live in a 60 square mile city that has zero agricultural land. We have 700,000 residents and about 20 million visitors come to DC annually. Add to that, we have, you know, more congressional meddling. We have limits on the height of our buildings here in DC that are also set by Congress. You name it, Congress has decided that they need to meddle in it here in DC. Yeah. So you take all these things together, our lack of agricultural land, our, you know, population density, the number of visitors here, the fact that we can't build high, and what we have is an actual physical impossibility. I, you know, tried to do the math. I don't think it is physically possible. We simply do not have the physical space here in DC to accommodate cannabis cultivation sufficient for the demand. It's just a physical impossibility. So that's why I'm really, really interested in interstate commerce. And we have an interstate commerce cannabis industry. It's the cannabis industry that's been functioning just fine forever. It's the one we've known. It's the one we've grown up with. We've got producer states in the Northwest supplying consumer states like mine. It's not new. It's not hard. But instead of just rolling with this natural market that exists, you know, we decided it's better to create like nearly 40, artificial, insular, inefficient, energy sucking, cost prohibitive markets all around the country. And these markets are failing for these very reasons. So we're not going to see federal action. I just have no faith in that. And so we have to get creative and explore, you know, some interstate agreements and how we can do that without, you know, getting the federal government involved. So, you know, Washington, Oregon, California, they've already passed legislation that would, in fact, allow for interstate commerce, you know, with an opinion from the DOJ or a memo from the DOJ. And then California, their regulators have even gone a step further. I really applaud them. I'm actually quite envious of their kind of activist, proactive stance that they're taking on this. You know, the California regulators have asked their attorney general to actually opine on, you know, what's the legal risk that might be posed to the state From interstate commerce between like California licensees and, you know, licensees in other regulated jurisdictions. But these are really all producer states, you know, Oregon, California, Washington, and they're taking these bold steps, but, you know, it's not like they're going to sell to each other. So what we really need are kind of forward-thinking leaders in consumer jurisdictions like my own, you know, to get on board as well. And that's why I'm, you know, entering these types of conversations, because we can't do it here in DC. And let's go with the market that works. Like I said, we have very few licensed establishments meet here, but a lot of unregulated establishments, and their cannabis is obviously coming from Washington, Oregon, California. So like, let's just roll with the market that's rolling with us.
I mean, on one hand, the infrastructure is there, and you know, I know the webinar itself is going to get into some of the finer details or more detailed specifics about this issue. And we'll make sure to share information on the webinar with our listeners. I know this episode will come out after the fact, but we'll point folks in the direction to review those materials. So rather than having you get into a bunch of those details that you'll probably be talking about in just a few hours here, I was curious if there's anything that maybe current licensed operators might do now to prepare for a future with interstate commerce. And I guess this question could go in a couple different directions. We could talk about DC retailers who might begin to prepare themselves to work with out-of-state growers, or we could certainly talk about operators outside of DC as well in segmented state markets, if you're comfortable going in that direction. But, you know, we're always talking about, you know, how operators can prepare for federal legalization, whatever in the world that might look like. But with this specific issue, this will certainly change the dynamics of state by state markets. Is there anything that maybe current license operators might do to begin even just thinking about this possibility?
Yeah, as a former regulator, I guess at this point, I'm always, you know, looking for what are the rules and regs, you know, that are existing outside of the space I'm operating in. And so I, you know, always encourage folks, find the most stringent rules that are out there. Rules in terms of like use of pesticides, you know, testing for contaminants, packaging, labeling, all of those. Find the rules that are strictest and see how you measure up against those. Because when it's go time, you don't want to be left behind because, you know, you're not getting all of the required tests done on your product, or your packaging is not compliant with, you know, six of the states you might be interested in working with. So if you get ready now, it won't be such a heavy lift later on. So although you might be exceeding what is required in your state right now, you'll be ready when it's time to export or import from some other jurisdiction. You don't want, you know, these opportunities to arise and you're just not able to take advantage of them. And then also, you know, start making business connections, you know, beyond your state. Because of this artificial systems that we've put in place, obviously everybody's, you know, supply chain is completely insular and within their own jurisdiction. But look at the full supply chain and what should that look like? And hell, like I said, go back to the original cannabis market. What does that supply chain look like? Understand it. I mean, you've got, you know, all these quote unquote businessmen out here, but these quote unquote businessmen are not the ones thriving. It's the folks who were working in the unregulated market who are actually, you know, thriving right now. What are you thinking about where you're able to access better quality or cheaper or more efficient goods and services throughout your supply chain? And if that means looking to the traditional market, to the legacy market, to the unregulated market, whatever you want to call it, do that. Because that's been functioning a lot longer than you have.
Yeah, I think especially here in 2023, that's a very salient and sound piece of advice for a lot of folks. You know, there are certainly a lot of businesses who have been in the license landscape for a number of years at this point, but there are folks entering the space every day, and there's a lot of that text that's going to be important for them to have and essentially arm themselves with as this industry you know, rapidly changes. You know, a lot of things are going to be different in the next couple of years. It's hard to say what that looks like, but certainly interstate commerce is in that conversation. With that being said, of course, with the webinar coming up very soon, Rafi, I really appreciate the time this morning. I'll be eagerly following along with the webinar, and I'll point our listeners in that direction as well. And thanks so much for the insight this morning.
Thank you so much, Eric. You have a wonderful day.
And that's a wrap on another episode of Beyond the Show. Hope you enjoyed my conversation with Rafi Elia Crockett. I know I did. It was great to get a chance to have the conversation about interstate commerce right before that webinar on interstate commerce. I did watch that the other day, and we'll make sure to share those details with this podcast episode as well. And just know that you can follow our own Cannabis Business Times reporting on interstate commerce. In fact, if you were to go to the website now and click the main menu in the top left corner, at least on the desktop version, click the main menu and go down, you'll see a link to our recent interstate commerce feature on just how that kind of policy might come to be, how it might take shape, and certainly how it will impact, or how it may impact, licensed cannabis businesses operating today. So there's a lot of unknowns in this issue, but it's very exciting, and there's a certain degree of inevitability to it. But what it will look like is much harder to say. So really appreciate getting the chance to talk with Rafi about what it might look like and how it might impact businesses. It's the kind of issue we'll be getting into at Cannabis Conference, of course, so make sure you check out cannabisconference.com to learn more about what we'll be talking about at the show this year. That's August 15th to the 17th out in Las Vegas. Day one, August 15th, is sort of a bunch of day-long activities. Whether you're a grower, we've got the VIP Cultivation Roundtable with very limited attendance, so make sure you get on that if you're interested. We've got day-long workshops on how to launch a dispensary business or how to launch a cultivation business if you're interested in getting into the industry. We've got that first day set aside for you. And then the next 2 days, the 16th and 17th, is sort of our more traditional conference with the expo hall, the educational sessions, the keynote speaker, the state of the industry, all these fantastic things that you've come to know and love at Cannabis Conference over the years. So we're very excited to share all of that with you. We're going to keep talking about it and sharing details between now and August. And then when August hits, we'll be out there. And like I say each week, we know that you're already thinking about getting out there. We know you have plans. You've got the date circled on your calendar. Make sure to log on to cannabisconference.com. Save yourself a few bucks right now. We're offering some deals. Get yourself signed up, and we'll see you in Vegas in no time.